Yes, we are up to 134. 134. It's all of three verses. Remember my rule, ladies and gentlemen. The smaller the chapter, the
But we'll
more
go through
there's
this
what to
last.
talk about. There is so much in this one. I hope we'll get through it. It's amazing. But we are up to number 134. And believe it or not, this is the final one in our section of 15 that we dedicated our time to study, the Shir HaMa'alot, the Song of Ascensions that we covered. There's 15 of them. Anybody remember why 15? This is your good prelude to the holiday of Passover. There are 15 steps to the Seder. Kadesh, Orchatz, Karpas, Yachatz. You go through it, there's 15. 15 is always the number associated with a step-by-step progression of reaching to a higher level. We pointed out when we first started this back in October after the unfortunate tragedy in Israel, and we took upon ourselves to learn these 15 Psalms, that there were 15 steps that led from the lower courtyard, the lower Azara courtyard in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple, that led to the next level. Remember, the Beit HaMikdash is sitting up on top of a mountain. So when you're heading up a level, you're walking up, and then you got to take some steps to get to the next level. So there are 15 upon which the Levites would stand, and they would sing, and with their musical instruments accompany all of the offerings that were brought in the Beit HaMikdash in the temple itself. So as part of our project, we decided we were going to learn these 15. This number right here, number 134, is the last in our grouping. And here's what it says: Shir HaMa'alot, the Song of Ascents. Hinei barchu et Hashem, kol avdei Hashem. Behold, bless the Lord, all those of you that are servants of God, ha'omdim bebeit Hashem balelot, who stand in the house of the Lord at night. Se'u yedechem kodesh ubarchu et Hashem. Lift your hands. I'll read what it says, in the holy place, and bless the Lord. And Yivarechecha Hashem mitzion, osei shamayim va'aretz. May the Lord bless you from Zion, he who made heaven and earth. Simple. We should be able to plow through this. We can all get an early recess, be in bed by 8:23. Not a problem. We got this. Okay. Let's start at the beginning. Okay. Song of Ascent, just address that. Behold, Baruchu et Hashem. Does that sound familiar to anybody? The phrase Baruchu et Hashem? It should.
Shabbat prayer.
Okay. It's not only on Shabbat, believe it or not, it's every day. Every day is part of the Shacharit service. That's usually the opening line. Right after Yishtabach, the end of Psukei Dezimra, we start with Baruchu et Hashem HaMevorach, which we also use when someone gets an aliyah. It is an invitation. Come, let us all, it's in the plural. Behold, in English, it doesn't say it. Behold, bless the Lord, but it's Baruchu, let us, we, in the plural, should bless Hashem. Who's the we? Kol Avdei Hashem, all those that are servants to Hashem. What's so special about these servants of God? They're the ones who stand in the house of the Lord at night. So let's talk about a few ideas. Let's start with the basics here. Let's turn this off. I know everybody loves to see my face much more than the text. Fine, be that way. What is this idea of Baruchu et Hashem? Let us bless God. Now, if it's very nice, I mean, it's a beautiful sentiment. But it really logically or theologically, it makes no sense. It makes zero sense whatsoever. How can I, puny little me, bless God, the infinite being? What do I have that I can bestow this blessing upon him? If I walk over to somebody who is not independently wealthy and I wish them the blessing that they should become wealthy, that makes sense. It's something they're lacking. something that they don't have, and you're wishing them the blessing that they have what it is they want. I wish somebody good health. Why? Because as we get older, our health declines. That's just the way life goes. So you can offer someone a blessing when it's something that they are lacking. So who came up with this idea, or what possesses us to think that I'm going to give a blessing to God? What am I going to give him? What do I have? My good looks? He's already got it. My independent wealth? He's already got it. What am I offering God that I'm going to bless him?
Your spirituality.
My spirituality? My
No.
spirituality is nothing compared to his
No.
spirituality.
Your gratitude.
My gratitude. I'm okay with the idea, but is that really the translation of a bracha, a blessing? It
Is
should
it
be a thank you.
it's
In
a
Hebrew,
gift.
there's a word
Yeah.
for that. It's modim. Like we say every morning when we get up, it's mode ani lefanecha. I give thanks. Modim, not bracha. I got you, Robin. Hold on. Bracha is a blessing. But Robin's going to enlighten us. Go
I
ahead.
hope so. That we would follow the mitzvahs of the Torah that was given to us.
There also, it's true. It's a nice thing. But what if I don't? Or if nobody does? Does that do anything for God? Does my performance or lack of performance of any mitzvah change God in any way, shape, or form? The answer is
Well,
no.
you're blessing God because you're in His image, so you're going to do what. You know, in his image, he wants to follow the mitzvahs and the Torah. So that's what, how you're blessing him by acting in his image.
How is that blessing him?
It's good. It's blessing. It's showing good. You know, I don't know how to explain it. Like goodwill, I guess, that this is what we're doing.
Goodwill? Yeah, I'm saving my own skin. I'll leave it at that, right? That if I'm going to go ahead and follow God's commands, then yeah, I'm going to be on his good side. But he's giving me more than I'm giving him. I'll prove it to you. If I don't do it, he's still God. And guess what? My tuchus is in the frying pan. So what am I giving him? Pleasure? I'm giving him the enjoyment that he created someone who's serving him. I can begin to hear that, but it's a strange terminology that I'm going to bless God. And we say this all the time. Every bracha we make, Baruch Atah Hashem, blessed are you, Hashem. Yeah, really? What am I telling you? What am I giving to you? So the commentaries all talk about this. Early commentators. I'm talking like, just post the Talmud, 2,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago, they say something phenomenal. They talk about the idea that the word bracha is related to the word in Hebrew berecha. A berecha is a flowing spring, right? A reservoir of water, a collection, a pool of water that is constantly flowing. They brecha. In modern Hebrew, a swimming pool is called a brecha in modern Hebrew. So the idea of brecha is not I'm giving God anything, nothing. I have nothing to give him. God lacks nothing. Tuchman has nothing to offer God. Rather, it's a statement of fact. You, God, are the source of all that flows into this world. All blessing that comes into this world, you, God, are the source of it. I'm not offering God anything. I'm making a statement. I always thought growing up that a bracha was either a mirror, like you said, it's a gratitude, it's a thank you. So maybe. But that's really not the word. A bracha is a statement of fact. Baruch atah Hashem. Fact. Blessed are you, Hashem. Not I'm blessing you. I'm acknowledging you, in fact, are the source of bracha in this world. Statement of fact, not a request, not a I'm giving you something you don't have. It's a statement of fact. You are the source of all of it. The more appreciation and acknowledgement that I have that God is the source, the more the flow of bounty will continue. Maybe that's, Muriel, what you meant in terms of gratitude. It's an acknowledgement that you are.
Why isn't there a verb? I don't read Hebrew, but it doesn't sound. Shouldn't it say, blessed are you?
Well, you can't ask me from the English translation, but that is the translation. Blessed are you, Hashem. That's what Baruch Atah Hashem, at the intro of every blessing, that is the correct translation. You are blessed, not I'm blessing you. You should be blessed. Incorrect. It's a statement, an acknowledgement of fact. You, God, are the source of all blessing. Hence, when I go ahead and I say Baruch Hu et Hashem, what I'm doing is I'm calling out to the congregation and I'm saying, come, everybody, let's join in the acknowledgement that you, God, are the source of all blessing. Do you know how powerful a statement that is? When I do it by myself, that's a wonderful individual achievement that I, in my personal life, acknowledge that. That's wonderful. God gets tremendous pleasure out of that. Now multiply it when you have a whole congregation saying that in unison. Come, let us bless God, i.e., come, let us acknowledge God, you are the source of all blessing. That's why a bracha is so powerful, because it's the ultimate statement of all of it comes from you. You are the source. And the more I acknowledge it, the more God says, I'm happy to give you. You're not taking credit for yourself. You're giving credit where credit is due. I'm happy to keep giving you more. Fred.
Somewhere I had learned, and whether it was from Shoresh or some rabbi, that God created man so that man could, it's probably not the right terminology, bless God, but I think acknowledge God. In other words, man was created so that it was a relationship. I forget
yes,
how it
that
actually
is true. That is true. Yeah. I don't disagree with that at all. The we're going to get to it when we talk about these servants of God. We're going to talk about that, of what that really means. But just as an opening statement, Shir HaMa'alot, this is a song of ascension, Hine, behold, Baruch Hu et Hashem, an acknowledgement of blessing God. Like the word Brecha is that spring of bounty that continues to flow. So let's go back to this verse for a second here, so we can see it and appreciate it. Right? Behold, not let us bless the Lord. Again, that if you want to just translate the words, that is what it says. But what it means is, behold, let us acknowledge that you, God, are the source of blessing. Who is this referring to? What seems to be a select group of individuals called Avdei Hashem, servants of God. I don't know about you, but again, growing up, the concept that somebody is an Eved, very often it's translated as a slave. Okay, the softer term might be a servant, but an Eved is someone who is subservient to someone or something else. That is what the definition is. How do you say to work or work in Hebrew?
Avodah.
Avodah. Avodah is from the word eved. Avodah means you are working for someone or something. So an eved is the one who embodies the concept of being subservient to others, hence the word slave or servant. So what exactly is this group? Those who serve God. Bless or acknowledge God as the source of all blessing. You who are servants of God. What King David here is telling us, and to really appreciate this, I'm going to share with you a couple of really, I think, very important ideas. But what David HaMelech here is saying is that these group of people who are serving God wholeheartedly, who are even willing, who stand in the house of the Lord at night. We'll talk a little bit more about this, but I don't know about you, but what do we normally do in the middle of the night? Most of us.
Sleep.
Sleep. And yet, what are they doing?
Praying.
This group. What?
They're praying.
They're serving God. They are standing in the house of the Lord, not by day when it's convenient, but even at night. And we're going to talk about this. But I want to share with you first two insights about this serving Hashem. Do you know where this term Eved Hashem, servant of God, can anyone cite me a place in the Torah itself where God actually uses that term to describe someone? Anybody want to venture a guess?
Saying Abraham?
It's a good guess, but not correct.
Okay.
Monroe's going for the keyboard. Hold on. He's going for it. It's actually Moshe, Moses. Moshe, at the very end of his life, God himself refers to him as Eved Hashem, the servant of God. It's a very interesting term. And I want to share with you an amazing story. They asked the question of all the different attributes. If you were going to give a eulogy for Moses, you can come up with probably quite a long list of attributes that Moshe embodied that deserves a praise as a eulogy. Humility would come, you know, towards the top of our list. Leadership of the people, self-sacrifice. I mean, there's a lot that we can say. And instead, God refers to Moshe towards the end of his life and describes him in two simple words, Eved Hashem, servant of God. And the commentators want to know, why is that the ultimate praise? Two simple words, calling the greatest prophet the Jewish people ever had, with just as a simple servant, seems to be underwhelming. Listen to a great story. All right, Mordechai Kamenetsky told the story about 20 years ago. I loved it. He talked about Frederick the Great, the king of Prussia, during the late 1700s. He was once reviewing his troops, and he noticed a middle-aged soldier with wearing a very interesting ornament. Dangling from what appeared to be an heirloom watch chain was a spent casing of a bullet. Not a watch, but a spent bullet. It had been polished, it had been shined, and it replaced the watch that obviously the soldier could not afford to get. The king, obviously in a playful mood, he pulls his diamond-studded pocket watch from his vest, and he's holding it up to the sunlight, and of course it's glistening off the sun's rays, and it's just, the diamonds are beautiful. And he stares at the watch intently, and then he looks at the soldier, and he says, "My dear soldier," as he tugs on the chain, says, "My timepiece says that it's 1:30. What does yours tell?" Soldier looked down at the bullet, and he says, "Your honor, the ornament that dangles from my watch chain does not tell me time. Rather, it is a bullet." The king scoffs, "A bullet? Why on earth would you wear a bullet instead of a watch?" Listen to his words. He says, "To me, your honor, there are no hours, minutes, or seconds. My watch tells me that every moment I'm willing to take a bullet, even if it means my life for your majesty." King Frederick was so impressed with the soldier's response that he went ahead, took off his royal watch, and he gave it to the soldier. What the Torah here is telling us, the accolade that you can give to a person, that most people, if you were to ask them, they would personify their wisdom, their wealth, their accomplishments. Torah says that's not the ultimate. The accolades really that identify are the accomplishments of why you're here on earth. The greatest praise that the creator of the universe can give a person are two words. You lived your life as someone serving his creator. There can be no greater accomplishment. It explains why you're here on earth. Rabbi Kamenetsky uses the words. He says, Moshe was totally subservient to the will of his creator, making him a mortal extension of God's immortal existence. What a great line. Moshe's entire essence, his raison d'etre, his whole reason for being here, was for one purpose only, to serve Hashem in whatever capacity that was. That's the greatest praise that a person could ever have. So here, David HaMelech, King David here in this psalm, makes note of the fact that these are special people who are Avdei Hashem. These are true servants of God. How does he know that? Because what do? They get up in the middle of the night, or they stay up late at night, and they're serving God. They're praying. They're learning. They're doing something while the rest of us are sleeping. Where we focus on our creature comforts to make sure that we're comfy. I have a teacher. I have never confirmed this, but I am 100% convinced he never, quote unquote, goes to sleep. That doesn't mean he doesn't sleep, but he never, I can only speak for myself. I'm in great company, so I don't know what all of you do. For me, I look at my clock or I look at my watch at some point in the evening, night, and I say, you know, it's really time for me to go to bed. I look at the time and decide it's time to go to bed. I don't think he functions that way. I think he functions that he goes as long as he can, and then he sleeps, gets a little whatever he needs, and then he gets up and he keeps going. He's not on a schedule of, you know, oh, it's 11:30. I have to be in bed by midnight. If he's feeling good, he'll go to 1 o'clock, and then he's tired. He'll go to sleep for a few hours, and then he'll get up and he'll start his routine. He'll do what he does until he's tired. And if he means he has to take a nap at 3 p.m. for an hour, he'll do that. And then he'll continue. And he'll just keep going. I'm convinced of that because I have reached out to him multiple times in my life, many times. And it doesn't make a difference what time. If I need to call him, the rule is don't bother calling him before midnight. Don't call him before midnight. He's not available. He's not sleeping. He's got other things and responsibilities. If you want to talk to him, you start calling him at midnight. And I will email him sometimes because I'm a wuss and sometimes I can't stay up past midnight. So I'll send him an email on my timetable and I'm shocked because the timestamp is 3 a.m., 4 p.m., 6 a.m., 11:30 p.m. It doesn't make a difference. No time frame. He's an Eved Hashem. He's serving God with whatever he got. He doesn't, quote unquote, go to sleep. He learns at night. He answers questions at night. He gives guidance at night. Doesn't make a difference. That's the way he functions. Again, this is unconfirmed reports. Don't quote this in the AP News. I'm telling you, though, it's 100% true. Because there's no other way he functions. It's not possible. That's an Eved Hashem, somebody whose whole day and night is focused, how can I serve God? If it means serving my people, then I'm available to help my people. If it means serving God because I have a good voice, then I make sure that I'm at services and I help join the congregation or I lead services. It doesn't make a difference. You are here. If you're an attorney, you're a doctor, you're a teacher, you're whatever, social worker, you are serving God by helping make the world a great place. That's your whole day is like that. But there's something very special about. Oh, so now going back for a second here. Do we have time for that? All right, I'll hold off on it. We may come back to this idea. But what's this idea about specifically at night? Why is learning at night considered such a great thing? Okay, simple answer, as I told you, is because the rest of us are all sleeping and he's pushing himself to continue. but there's much more. The Talmud actually discusses, you know, we're in the month of Adar, right? We're about next week, God willing, we're going to move into, well, the following week, we'll be into the month of Nisan, okay? And the days are getting longer, which means the nights are getting shorter, okay? As we move through the summer months, it, so to say, reaches its pinnacle, usually right in the middle of the summer, what we call around the month of Av, right? Famously with Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of Av, right? That's the saddest day on the Jewish calendar. The Talmud says that on the 15th of Av, the Talmud says, now that the nights are getting longer, people have to learn more Torah at night. The longer the night, you're translating, yes, the longer I can sleep. The Talmud says, no, the longer the night, the more opportunity and responsibility to study Torah, because what do you think the night is created for? The Talmud quotes another idea. One who studies Torah at night is blessed, what's called a chut shel chesed, a thread of kindness, meaning that you're going to find favor in the eyes of others during the day. I don't know. What does one thing have to do with the other? The Rambam, Maimonides, codifies in his Code of Jewish Law that although the mitzvah of learning Torah is both by day and by night, he says that the bulk of a person's wisdom is acquired from the Torah he learns at night, not by day. I'm not telling you not to study Torah by day. You didn't hear that from me. I'm telling you to do it by day, but you should know that you're studying 8 o'clock at night on Wednesday nights on Zoom. You're fulfilling even more. Not that I know anybody like that, but just in speaking in general terms, the Torah you study when it's dark, nighttime, is a greater level. What is so special about nocturnal Torah study? This is what many of the commentaries are wondering. I heard many answers, but I got to share one with you that I thought was excellent. You see, what a person does by day really is an obligation. What do we normally do by day? Not just Torah, but I'm saying just your life. What do you normally
work? Work. Work.
Work. What else?
Chores.
Chores. Take care of the needs for the family, your community. It's things that you really have an obligation to take your responsibilities. That's what your day is usually. What is nighttime usually synonymous with? Rest.
Doing things.
Free time.
Right. Rest, relaxation, free time, do what I want. It's my chance to just unwind. There's a certain natural affinity towards just let your hair down and kick back and go to your default position, which for many people is this now, and for other people it's like this, holding the screens, right? Or something like that. That's the default mode. So now, if a person is so enthralled with the opportunity to learn Torah to the point that they're willing to take, quote unquote, their free time, the time that naturally they feel is their time to chill and focus on themselves, just, you know, relax and rest up, and you go ahead and you push yourself to want to go to a class, you push yourself to study a little extra, you know, at 9 o'clock when Tachman finally lets you off, maybe 9:15, he lets you out. Do you just close the Zoom and that call it a day? Maybe you stay for an extra 2 minutes, like Robin, I'm sure, does, and she finishes writing over her notes because she didn't finish yet. That wasn't a joke. I mean that very seriously. I'm always amazed, Robin. I really am. Kudos to you. It's fantastic. Right? And there, you know, maybe some of you at that point you close the Zoom and then you say your Shema for the night. But you're not done. That shows a certain level of dedication. Hashem says somebody like that, where you're serving me even when your natural inclination is to turn it off and down, you know, whatever is, you know, to take it down a step and you ratchet it up a step. That's amazing. God says, I give all the blessings in the world to you. You're truly someone who's serving Hashem and not just checkbox. I learned Torah today. Woohoo! I did that at 9:15 this morning, done till 9:15 tomorrow morning. No. You're learning at night. It shows a certain level of commitment and dedication. Hashem says, I'm there for you. So this is what King David is saying. Come, Baruch Hu es Hashem, let us acknowledge God. Who? Kol Avdei Hashem, all those who serve God, who stand at or in God's house, even at night. Even at night. That's the first understanding. But you know what? We've seen before, the symbolism of night represents what? What does night represent as opposed to day?
Death.
Could be. That's an extreme example of dark. That's true. But there's, let's take a little step back and not be so extreme of. How about just exile or challenges and difficulties in life? That's more associated with the darkness as opposed to light, where things are clear and smooth and right. Imagine how precious it is when a person is in a difficult situation and nevertheless says, I'm going to daven. I have my doubts. I have my issues that I'm going on in my life. And I say, you know what? I still need to carve out time for my relationship with God, as Fred said, right? It's all about my relationship. I'm going to, even when things are tough, it's easy to throw it down and say, I don't got time for this. I got so many things to worry about. You come to realize the more things you have to worry about, the more you need to carve out time to have that relationship with Hashem. So the commentators write that this is also referring to at this point of the difficulties when there's challenges and adverse conditions and you're still able to do it, how precious that is in the eyes of Hashem. It's almost, and the way they phrase it, is standing at your post at night. I'll tell you, one of the nicest things somebody said about my father. My father, Zichrono Livracha, his yahrzeit is actually next week. And when he passed away, one of my brother's friends, who used to daven in the same shul as my father, you know, if you ever watch somebody davening, most people, in the midst of the service, especially the Amidah, they're swaying. Right? They're getting into it. There's a certain feeling. In Yiddish, it's called shuckling. Shuckling. Right? You've seen this, right? Most people do that. My father didn't do that. My father stood absolutely still. He just stood and he focused. He looked in the siddur and that was it. This fellow, after my father passed, he said it was so amazing to watch my father in services. And he described my father when he was praying as a sentry at his post. That's how he described it. Because for my father, that's what it meant. If you're in shul, you're in the midst of a conversation with God and you have a mission and you stood there and you focused. You know, guys like me, so, you know, I'll walk a little bit, I'll roam a little bit, I'm saying the words, I'm into it and stuff, but he was in a zone. He was very much in a zone. He was like a sentry at its post. Do you know that in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple itself, there were 24 areas around the Temple Mount area that there were guards and sentries posted throughout the night, not for protection reasons. There was no enemy that was coming in that way, but rather what we would call the honor guard. It was a certain kavod, a certain respect, that you stood at your post, you know, just like the guards outside Buckingham Palace. It's not for protection. They don't have guns. I mean, maybe they do, but it's not for protection. There's a certain honor. You're standing in front of the king or the queen's palace. Standing in the Beit HaMikdash, there were Kohens, more specifically Levites, who stood at their post. 24 guards at night. This is what that means. Going back to our verse, that's what that, I think, is referring to here. All servants of the Lord who stand. What do you mean who stand? Did you say who study in the house of the Lord? What do you mean who stand? Why are they standing? And if they're sitting, it's a problem. I think King David is trying to impress this upon us. These servants who are dedicated wholeheartedly, they are sacrificing their comfort, their sleep, in order to be in the house of the Lord. They're standing guard. Yeah, I'm sure they were sitting and learning. I'm sure they were swaying when they... But the concept that they stand at the house of God, even at night, that is really a great definition of what it means to be an Eved Hashem, a servant of God. Okay, let's go to verse number 2. Se'u yedeichem kodesh, lift your hands in the holy place. And again, ubarchu et Hashem, and quote unquote, bless God. So what do you mean, lift your hands in the holy place? Anybody venture a guess? Like, who's lifting hands to bless God?
My book says lift your hands in prayer.
Okay.
It's the translation. Well, and in praise of the Lord is the next line. So you're lifting your hands and praying towards God.
When you pray, do you lift your hands, Fred?
No. So I guess maybe not, those days. I mean,
I guess you're not one of those servants of the Lord. So no, you're not. You're great. You're one.
No. I get what you're saying, but at the same time, didn't people lift up your hands to the Lord? There's a line of something like that somewhere
it's
else.
This one. This is the one you're thinking of.
Okay.
This is the verse everybody quotes. Right. Lift up your hands to the Lord and bless it. Yeah, this is it. Se'u yedeichem kodesh. I'll talk about that in 1 second. But the simple understanding, it's referring to Birchat Kohanim, the priestly blessings. They lift up their hands, right? And they're giving the blessing, conduit of blessing to God through them, God's blessing to the people. Fascinating law. Before the Kohens can do their priestly blessings, they do some ritual. Anybody know?
The washing of the...
Yes, they wash their hands beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
They wash their own hands?
I thought they were washed by the Levites.
Correct. The Levites wash the hands of the Kohen before the Kohen performs the priestly blessings. It's a law. There's a whole discussion in halacha. What if there's no Levite in the congregation that day? Who does it? Do they wash each other's hands? Does a non-Levite do it? Who's next in line? Anybody know?
The Israelite. If in the three order of things, it's Kohen, Levite, and Israelites. So.
Right, but that's not the case here. The Israelite does not get the opportunity to do it unless I'll just tell you.
It's the Benjaminites.
Good guess, but nope. Because we don't know who's from which tribe anymore. Well, I'm saying most people have no, unless they're a Kohen or a Levi, they really don't know. Or unless they know their lineage all the way back to someone who we do know. But the vast majority of us have no idea. You know, I just assume I'm from the best looking tribe, but I really don't know. I don't really know which one it is. But so most people don't know. The law is that if there's no Levi, then a Bechor, a firstborn. Yes, a firstborn can have that privilege if there's no Levi. Good piece. Again, by the time I'm done with all of you, you guys are going to totally rock Jewish Trivial Pursuit because you're going to know all the answers to these kinds of trivial questions. Fine. Okay. So the Talmud learns out that it's a requirement to wash hands. The Kohen have to wash their hands before doing the priestly blessings. The Zohar writes the rationale for that, or a rationale, is because we want to increase their level of sanctity. We always know that the concept of washing our hands, not for hygiene, but for purity, spiritual uplifting, leveling up. So if they're going to be the conduit by which God's blessings are going to be bestowed upon the people, so we want to give them a boost in spirituality also, so they wash their hands. That's what the Zohar writes. Okay. It's interesting that the Hebrew word here, lift your hands, doesn't say wash your hands. It says lift. raise. Sorry, Fred used the word raise, right?
Well, lift was what I have here.
All right, whatever. The point being, it doesn't say wash, but it's a matter of lifting up or raising. Why? I think it fits very light, nicely with this idea of where we're elevating. It's a matter of spiritually elevating, and it's not just in the physical sense, the hands that will go up to give the priestly blessings, but rather it's an elevation of the person who will be lifting their hands. Now, I will not hold you to it, but we talked about last year when we talked, you know, what was the name of our series?
Well, it was the house.
The Jewish home, right?
And you talked about what, lifting your hands when you washed your hands Friday night.
Okay, so good. So I'm not going to hold you to it, but very good, Fred. We talked about this. So let's spend 2 minutes just to review that, because I think it's really important as it pertains to this conversation. When the Kohens used to be in the temple, did you have a Levite wash their hands? The answer is no. There was actually a vessel. Let me turn this off for a second.
Remember that.
There was a vessel, a kli called the kior, K-I-Y-O-R, kior. The kior in English is called the laver. And it basically was a huge basin that had water in it, and it had spigots. And the Kohens, before the Kohanim, before they would do their daily service, they would wash their hands and feet in it from the water from the laver. And that was a very special thing, similar to what we do when we get up in the morning. We wash Netilat Yadayim, we wash our hands. Or before we eat bread, we wash our hands. Before a service to God, they wash their hands and feet. Okay. What was so special about this kiyar? What material was it made from? I'll give you three choices. Gold, silver, copper.
I thought it was gold.
Fred says gold.
Copper.
Muriel says copper. Marsha, what'd you say?
Copper.
Copper. Sharon also copper. No silver?
Wasn't it made from the mirrors that the women donated?
Okay, you are 100% correct. And that is, it is made from copper, and it was made from the mirrors that the women used in the story of the Exodus. Remember, the building of the tabernacle, when they built these vessels for the first time, it was right after they left Egypt. The women had mirrors. You know, you think that's a new invention that Goody made? What's the name of that company? Goody? The hair company, right? Goody? Yeah, I got lots of girls in my house. I learned this stuff. Okay. And as my hair goes further back, the Goody bobby pins are doing less and less good for me. So whatever. They would have mirrors because they wanted to make themselves look beautiful. Why? The Torah actually tells us that the men, because they were so broken and so beat from the servitude in Egypt, crazy as it sounds, they had no interest in being intimate with their spouse. They weren't, that's like, what's the point? We're going to have more children so that Pharaoh can kill them? They weren't interested. And the women went out of their way to make themselves look beautiful, to entice their husbands so that the Jewish family can still exist. They donated. When Moshe asked for donations, the women all came forward and gave forth their copper mirrors. You know, you take copper and you shine it, it becomes a mirror. And Moshe did not want to accept it. Moshe felt this is used for lust. It's using for, you know, more physical stuff. It's not appropriate for a spiritual building, the temple. And God said, Moshe, you're terribly wrong. Absolutely not. In fact, just the opposite. It is vital to have this. And in fact, it was from those copper mirrors that the laver, the kiyar, was made, that the Kohens would wash themselves, hands and feet, to prepare themselves for the greatest service of the day, serving God in the temple. What's the connection? The commentaries want to understand why. What is so significant about this that it would be so important that this would be it? The answer comes down to this very simple idea. And that is, you have to choose what you're going to focus your energies and your what it is you want to accomplish. The hands are always representative of work. You work with your hands. even if you're using your head, and even if you're a teacher and you're using your mouth to teach, hands represent human activity, right? Maybe that's why guys like me, we can't teach without our hands. It's the craziest thing. I'm always moving my hands when I'm trying to teach. I don't know. Does it help you in receiving my message because I'm using my hands? I don't know, but I got to do it. Hands are always the representation of action, human activity. When they go ahead and wash their hands and feet before the service of God, they're doing it from the greatest lesson. The women who dedicated their activity, even in the most physical way, they elevated it so that there would be a Jewish family. It was considered kadosh, kadosh, kadosh.
Holy,
holy, holy in the eyes of Hashem, what the women did. So much so that every morning upon rising, the Kohen washed his hands and feet from the kiyar before doing the service. He was setting aside something for this lofty, meaningful purpose, and he learns it from the women. He learns it from them, that you can take any of the physical activities and elevate it, raise it up for a holy purpose, which is exactly what they did. Hence, before the Kohens are going to lift their hands, representing action, human activity, through which God is going to bestow blessing, you know what they have to do? They have to wash their hands. It was a throwback to what we learned from the Kohens who would wash their hands from the kiyar every morning before they came into the service. Perhaps that's even the reason why the custom is, and it's brought down in halacha, that when we wash our hands for bread, ladies and gentlemen, listen to this. When you wash for bread, right? So you wash to the right, two to the left, or three to the right, three to the left, depending on what your custom is. What do you do right then? You finished washing. Your hands are wet. Now what?
Lift them up.
You lift them up.
Yes. You lift them up, right? This way, actually, right? With your palms facing you. And you lift them upwards, right? Eye level. My grandfather had the custom that when he did that, he lifted, he would say our verse. Se'u, this pasuk, se'u yedechem kodesh, ubarchu es Hashem. Lift up your hands to God. Lift them up for holiness and bless God. And then he would make the bracha. Sher kedushanu b'mitzvosav v'tzivanu al netilat yadayim, and then we dry it. This is the verse that's the source of it. When we talked about it in our class, we talked about perhaps this concept of lifting up the hands and elevating it is almost symbolically like raising the antenna, raising your antenna for better transmission so that you can receive the greatness from above, like putting up greater antenna. Nowadays, it looks like, what? What's an antenna for the television? What are you talking about? You know, just adjust the dish. What? What are you talking about? It's streaming 5G, Rabbi. What are you talking about? Yeah. Ching. Right? No idea.
I said you also mentioned that raising
it. I said to somebody not that long ago, I said, you sound like a broken record. Huh? And no idea what I was talking about. And to explain it to the person, it fell flat like a lead balloon.
Mm-hmm.
A broken record? What? So, but maybe that's the reason. Maybe that's the reason, so that we can connect, you know, with a greater sense of. But that's what we use our hands for. When we go out and we go inside and out of our homes and we kiss the mezuzah, use your hand. Right? It's that constant action and activity reminding us that no matter what action and activity I'm involved with, I have the ability to raise it up, to elevate it. That's what the whole concept of raising our hands is all about. This is why Birchat Kohanim, the priestly blessings, all involved about raising the hands. Okay, so that is verse number 2. Let me just see, there's also more about this. Fine, eating bread. Okay. One more piece on this, and then we'll do the last verse. Let's just look at this verse one more time. Okay. I want you to focus right here on this word in Hebrew. It means your hands, yideichem. Everybody see this? Should I make it larger? Let's make it a little bigger. No, bigger, today, bigger. There you go. Can everybody see it?
Yep.
It's here somewhere. Hold on.
Off the page.
Come on. Se'u yideichem. Right here. Se'u means to lift, yideichem, your hands. Now, typically, the word for your hands would be spelled similar to this. It would be spelled, first letter is the same, yud.
Isn't it yadayim?
Valid. And then would be one more yud. It would be yideichem. It would be yud, dalid, yud, chaf, mem. It's missing a yud. The second yud is missing. You see that?
Mm-hmm.
The typical way you would say your hands is yud dalid yud chaf mem, but it's missing it. Says the commentaries, I forget where it's from, but it makes the point that yideichem spelled without the yud, the second yud, could be read as to the singular person, your hands. If I want to say about one person, I want you to lift both hands, right? I would say se'u yideichem, but without the extra yud. If I want to say to the group, everybody, lift your hands, I would add the yud. Okay? Yideichem without the yud is singular. Not one hand, but to a single entity or a single person, both hands. You follow that? Why would King David spell this implying one single unit instead of everybody? Su yideichem, everybody, lift up your hands. Why in singular? Some suggest that it's talking about the Jewish people coming together as one. You can look at us as a group of individuals, one and another one and another one. And we become a people. David HaMelech wants to tell us that it's more than that. We actually have to bond together in unison. Se'u yideichem, lift up your singular entity called the Jewish people. We all have the ability to raise up and elevate all the things in our life, regardless of our station in life, regardless of our background, our education, doesn't make a difference. Everybody can join together as one to raise up the holiness that we have the ability to do every single day. Okay, last point. Let's do this last point. Let me move this. Let's take this last verse. Here we go. Last verse. Yivarechecha Hashem mitzion. May God bless you from Zion. We talked about this before. Osei shamayim v'aretz, he who made heaven and earth. Here also, you'll notice the very first word in Hebrew, right? In English, you can't tell from the word you, whether it's singular or plural. May the Lord bless you. Who's you? If I call you up and I say, Robin, I'd like to invite you for dinner. So obviously, I know that means you and Craig. But I said you. Maybe I only meant you, you know, because Craig blew me off, you know, 2 weeks in a row. Maybe I don't want to have him. No. So the answer is, in English, you can't tell whether you is singular or plural. In Hebrew, you can. Yivarechecha. Yivarechecha, may he bless you. And it's singular. It's a singular thing, similar to what we just said a moment ago about yideichem. If you in verse 2 can go ahead and unify, become one people, then guess what? God's going to bless you all as one people. That's a great blessing. But it goes better. Because what happens if I don't fulfill it in verse 2? And I'm not able to unify the Jewish people. Does that mean I'm out of luck for getting blessing from God? No, it doesn't. It's done in the singular to say that even in a situation of where you're the only one who's doing the right thing, you as a single individual are taking on conventional wisdom. You're taking on what everybody's, you still stand your ground, even as one person. God says you are worthy that everything should be done to rest my presence in your midst and give you all the blessings you need. It's worth it to me, God says, even if you're one individual. Can someone bring me a proof to that concept from the very beginning of world history? How many people were created at the beginning of history?
One.
One. One person. Adam. Think about it. For 6 days, God created the vastness of our universe. Every planet, every solar system, every star within the systems, systems we don't even know about. The vastness of creatures, the vastness of nature, the vastness of fish in the sea, birds in the sky, the oceans, the... For whom? For the first million people? No. For one single individual human being. The Mishnah states it outright, and this has become a famous idea, that one who saves one person's life is as if you save the world, is learned from that concept, that God created the whole universe for one person. So here, King David says, may the Lord bless you, even in the singular, as an individual. Why? Because when you go ahead and you become that Eved Hashem, that servant of Hashem who's willing to push himself or herself by day and by night, and you're willing to elevate your hands, everything that you touch, everything that you come and work for is all to raise the level of godliness in the world. God says, I bless you, and you become a partner with me in creation of heaven and earth. That's why it ends with this. May the Lord bless you from Zion, he who made heaven and earth. Really? Now in chapter 134, you're telling me this concept, which I know from the first verse in the Torah? What's this got to do with anything? The answer is, just like Adam, just like Adam Arishon, the very first man, who was the entire reason, let me say it better, who God felt was worthy of everything to be created of heaven and earth for that individual, you get the same blessing that God is willing and gives you the reins to remake heaven and earth. Think about the impact you can have. Just as God made heaven and earth, the power is so profound to make a difference in this world. As long as you take, it's a three, it's not even three, just follow the simple psalm. Be the one to acknowledge that God is the blessing in the world. Be the one who will serve God by day and by night, pushing yourself out of the comfort zone. Push yourself to lift your hands. You know what you can do? You can make such a profound difference in this world. You become a junior partner with God in the entire creation of heaven and earth. This is what King David ends when they do talk about the Song of Ascents. You know what you can be? Do you know what you can accomplish? Yeah, it's great to do it with everybody. And that's ultimately the goal of what we want. But don't ever, ever, ever underestimate the power of one. The power of you, the individual who can make that profound difference because you do what's right. You do it because you're here to serve God. You want to be that on your tombstone after 120 years, God would write and etch on it, you were an Eved Hashem. You were my servant who dedicated his or her life to making this world a better place by getting godliness more here. How's that for an epitaph? Nothing beats that. That's how God finished his eulogy, or was the entire eulogy for Moshe Rabbeinu. He called him an Eved Hashem. This, I believe, is why David HaMelech ends this section with this concept. And from that, I hope we take some level of inspiration. This has been fascinating to go through the 15 steps and to see the progression of building up our faith, building up our trust in tough times and in good times, praising God and acknowledging God, even all of it. It culminates with this. To be called an Eved Hashem, nothing beats that. Nothing. Period. Exclamation point. Take it and run. That's my ending to this. Okay. I'll answer questions in a moment, but let me just... let me turn this part on. Okay. So here's my suggestion. Next Wednesday, I'm gonna beg your indulgence to pass. It's the night before my daughter's wedding. I probably could get it in, but I don't know what's gonna be. So I'm gonna beg your indulgence to let me get a bye for next week. But the following week, that gives us, let's just look at the calendar very quickly. That gives us, next Wednesday is the 3rd. The following is the 10th. The following is the 10th. Hopefully we can do that. The 17th is fine. And okay, so here's my hope. My hope is that with the 10th and the 17th will be on and we'll focus on Pesach. We'll focus on the holiday of Pesach. We'll get hopefully two good classes. Worst case scenario, if it turns out that the 10th won't work for me, I'll let you know. But for sure, the 17th, we should be able to get in at least one session in terms of getting ready for Pesach. And then we'll talk about what for after Pesach, what we want to do, whether we want to continue with Psalms, another short subject matter. Give it some thought. We'll talk about it. But next, so just a review. Next week, we're not on. The following week, I'll let you know. But the week after that, the 17th, we should be good to go. Okay? So just want to make sure. Now I'm happy to take any questions if anybody has. Yes, Fred.
Well, rather than a question, although maybe it is, if you go into more Psalms, would it be possible to do the 8 or the 8 days? There are many, I read them every morning, you know, one every morning. Shabbat, I don't, usually I'm in services, but I've often wondered something like I wrote to you once. I was a little confused about the meaning of one of them, and each one seems to have its own particular. I would love to learn, like we did these, the meaning of the 8, at least 7, Sunday through Friday.
Oh, it's open for discussion. Definitely
okay.
Possible.
That would be my
okay.
Okay, that's that
Fair
would
enough.
Be my suggestion. Okay.
Fair enough.
I couldn't write fast enough. Something about. When you were talking about the last wing partner of God in creation, I kind of, is that it? Was there more to that?
Well, just like Adam Arishon, God created the entire universe just for one person, the vastness of our universe. Right. So too, King David here, when he uses the, may God bless you, he uses it in the singular, Yevarechecha, may God bless you, the individual. Implying that we are given that same opportunity, that the whole universe, the heavens and earth, where God created it, he also invites us as a servant of Hashem who's willing to do all that, to be a partner with him and to also remake heaven and earth, making a profound difference, just as he did it all for one individual in the formation of everything, so too he's willing to do that for the person who's so dedicated and wholehearted towards his service.
You say remake heaven and earth, then you mean make it better, make it a better place.
Make it, right, having a profound difference, correct.
Okay. I'm sorry, that's the part I think I missed. All right, thanks.
That's fine. Great. All right. Wonderful. Thank you all for joining. Great. And God willing, I will see you hopefully in 2 weeks. And that's about it. I think Purim, I think everybody looks recovered. We're missing one or two people, so it could be they're still hungover. Oh, well. There'll be a recording at least, you know. Maybe they'll listen. But either way, thank you for coming, and I will see you, Mirtz Hashem, God willing, in a couple of weeks.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Pleasure.
Good night, everybody.
Pleasure.
Thank you.